Welcome to Music from the Tower, highlighting the beauty of sacred and classical music. We come to you from the Tower of Hope on the magnificent campus of Christ Cathedral in Garden Grove, California. Now, here's your host, John Romeri.
And this is Music from the Tower, and this is John Romeri, your host, right here on the campus of the beautiful Christ Cathedral in the Tower of Hope. And today, we have somebody, this really should be retitled for this day, and called the Bell Towers of Hope. We've got Melissa Widener, our carillonneur, here from Christ Cathedral. Most times when you wander by that tower and you hear music going on, it's Melissa up there. Hi, Melissa. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you.
It's great to have you. Melissa has all sorts of great things. We usually keep her way at the top of Crane Tower, and today we let her come into the Tower of Hope. So it's wonderful to have you here with us today. We're going to talk about carillons and what a carillon is and hear some beautiful carillon music. And so, Melissa, what is a carillon? Tell us all about it.
So a carillon is usually found in a bell tower, and it has at least 23 cast bronze tuned bells that are arranged in a chromatic series. So when we think of a carillon, usually carillonneurs are referring to a traditional carillon, which is played by striking a keyboard that has long stick-like keys, and they're called batons. And these all operate mechanically. That's what makes it a traditional carillon.
And so you're really pulling the hammer from the keyboard.
Right. So the keys can be played with either open or closed fists, and then there's a pedal board similar to an organ. So that's played with the feet. And the keys mechanically activate levers and wires that connect to the clapper of the bell, and then that directly strikes the inside of the bell.
It's really quite a mechanism, isn't it?
Right. So it's kind of like playing a piano in that you can control the dynamics or the volume level by how much force is applied to the key.
Yes, she's got to be strong like ox.
That's right.
Because she's up there playing these gigantic bells. We're going to talk a lot about our carillon in a segment coming up. But right now, let's just talk about, okay, I'm a parishioner. I look up in my bell tower. I see a bell. Do I have a carillon?
Probably not.
Probably not.
So these traditional carillons, there are very few of them around. So
how many in the U.S. or the world even?
In the world, there are 600-something carillons.
Wow, that's a lot.
Not really.
Okay.
When you think of how many pipe organs there are.
Exactly. So not every parish has a carillon. How many do we have in Orange County?
One.
Right here at Christ Cathedral. Thank you for that plug. And how many in the U.S.? How many in California?
So in the U.S., there are about 160 carillons and not that many more carillon players. And in California, we have just six. So they're at Trinity Cathedral in San Jose, UC Berkeley, Stanford University, UC Santa Barbara, and UC Riverside.
So a lot more common in university settings, do you think?
Well, the main place you find them is typically either a university or a church.
Or a grand cathedral like Christ Cathedral. Well, we're so lucky here, and we're going to talk a lot more about our own carillon, where it came from, how much the bells weigh. But talk a little bit more about this touch sensitivity. A lot of people say, now, you're going to reconnect ours to the organ, right? And we are, of course, because we do want to be able to play it from the organ keyboard. But it's not the same, is it?
No, it's not. You can't adequately replicate the weightedness of playing at the actual carillon keyboard if you're doing it remotely. Technology is being worked on to improve that, but we still don't have the capability of replicating that touch really accurately.
Melissa does an amazing job, and she rightly quotes that it's like a piano. You know, the harder you bang the piano, the louder it is. And it was the first instrument actually called a pianoforte, right? Because it could play loud and soft on the very same keyboard. And Melissa does a great job of like bringing out the melody, and then you hear the other bells softer, and it's all by how much she pounds her fist. You know, so my Italian father used to pound his fist, but he wasn't a carillonneur, you know. Tell us some of your favorite places to play.
I've played recitals all over the country. You have more carillons on the East Coast than over here. they were just built earlier because being an older part of the country, that's what happened.
Been around, yeah.
So I've given a lot of recitals over there. My favorite carillon so far I've played was at Princeton University. Beautiful instrument. It had a really mellow tone, really resonant. It was just a beautiful instrument, very large instrument, too. There have been quite a few of them I've really enjoyed, but that was my favorite.
Oh, wonderful. Well, I went to Westminster Choir College right near that campus, so it was great to be on the Princeton campus and hear the bells as we go to the library or go to the chapel to do some things. It is an amazing instrument because it's in a tower. Here at Christ Cathedral, you have to climb a million ladders. I'm sure every one of these is a little hard to access, but it's just... How do you practice without disturbing the neighborhood? What happens? How do you make this work?
Well, if you don't care, you can just go practice and disturb the neighborhood.
I hear the petitions coming our way already. But
every carillon tower typically has a practice carillon associated with it. It's just the practical thing to do. So sometimes they'll be located at the base of the tower in a little practice room, or sometimes you have to go to a separate building to do it, which is more often the case. And the practice carillon, if you look at it, it looks just like the carillon keyboard that's up in the tower, except that the keys are not connected to the bells, but they're connected to something else. They might be connected to a system of tone bars that are struck by hammers, or the keys might be connected to a digital system that has recordings from actual carillons, or there are other different electronic means to make a practice carillon work.
So you actually can practice at least somewhere, and they have pedal boards too, right?
Right.
Just like the organ. And we have one here at Christ Cathedral in our cultural center, so at least we can do a little bit of practicing without getting all the neighbors upset as you're learning new pieces. And typically, how long does it take to, say, take a brand new piece and learn it from scratch? This sounds like a very difficult... You didn't practice scales with your fists. These are really fists going up and down, not just fingerings or... So it's really quite an intricate thing. On our Christ Cathedral Music Facebook page, you can see some of the performances from this season's Easter series. We'll talk a lot more about our own carillon series here at the cathedral in a segment coming up. But it's amazing to watch. Everybody loves it. We were Facebooking live this year, and everybody's listening to the bells and watching you on their phones and their iPads because it's just absolutely fascinating. How long to learn a brand new piece?
It really depends. It's kind of the same way I would approach piano or organ music. Depending on the difficulty of the piece, I might just go ahead and sight read something. Or,
oh dear.
You know, if it's something more virtuosic, I might spend several weeks or several months on it. It just depends. If it's a more difficult piece, it's like I'd approach something for another instrument, just practicing small segments bit by bit, repeating it a whole bunch. And there is a lot of practicing of scales and arpeggios, just like with other keyboard instruments.
So it's pretty much like learning any other piece.
That's right.
You just have to tear it apart and learn it, huh? Well, we're going to talk a little bit more in a coming segment about how Melissa came to this. Nobody grows up saying, I think I'm going to play the carillon. So we're going to find out just how she came to this incredible musical adventure. It certainly is an adventure here at Christ Cathedral, climbing up 11 ladders to get to the top of the tower. And what else she plays and what are some of her hobbies? So we have a lot more coming up with Melissa in the next couple segments. Please stay tuned. But now she's going to tell us about a little piece of carillon music that we're going to hear. This is called Prelude Number 8. Tell us about this piece and where you... This is Melissa performing, actually, recorded, and she'll tell you where.
Prelude 8 is by Matthias Vandengane, and he was a late Baroque, early classical period composer, a Flemish composer, and he was from a family of bell founders, which makes him pretty unique as a carillon composer. He was an organist and a caroloner and composed mostly for his two instruments, organ and carillon. He has a collection of 11 preludes for carillon that are among the most frequently performed pieces for carillon because of their virtuosity and because of how they make use of the minor third overtones of the bells, and he made those really specifically work well with his compositions.
So do most compositions come as a carillon piece, or are most pieces arrangements of other things?
I think of the total published collection of Carillon works, it's probably something like 50-50. We have a good deal of original compositions for Carillon, and also a lot of arrangements largely from the standard classical repertoire, and also arrangements of hymns.
Kind of we've enjoyed so many beautiful hymn settings, fabulous arrangements. Some, I bet, are also Melissa's, right?
Improvisations, more like.
Yes, exactly. So it's an improvisatory instrument, too. All right, here's Prelude number 8, and we will be right back. This is Music from the Tower, and we have a lot more to learn about carillons. With Carolyn Ure. That's a fun word to say, Melissa.
Everybody Carolyn. Says it differently.
I know. You say it. You're the expert.
I say Carolyn Ure. I've heard Carolyn Ure, Carolyn Ure, Carolyn Ure, all kinds of things.
Yes. My teacher in college used to say Carol Manure. I mean, there's all sorts of ways to say this, but however you say it, we have Carolyn Ure, Melissa Widener here. She is just a fabulous person, and she has been so generous to us here at Christ Cathedral, playing our carillon for a raft of occasions. But let's talk about how Melissa Widener, a person, came to be Melissa Widener, Carolyn Ure. Did you come from a big musical family? Is that how this all started? And what were your first instruments? And who were your mentors?
Well, I'm the only musician in my family. I had a great grandmother who played piano. That's the only musician I know of, but never met her. So I started piano lessons when I was 4 or 5, so I've been playing piano pretty much my whole
life. So that was instrument number one.
Right.
Okay.
And I really enjoyed it. I didn't practice a whole lot when I was a kid, but it was something that I did, and I thought it was fun.
You know your piano teacher's listening. That's not good. Okay. She practiced a lot. She really
I got serious about it later on.
Okay.
And then when I was in high school, I started getting involved in church music. I went to Modern Day High School in Santa Ana. And
so she's local Southern California Carol, okay.
Right. And one of our graduation requirements was to do 80 hours of community service. And so I was thinking for a way to make that fun. So I was playing saxophone in the school marching band.
Oh, how fun. I played sax in the school.
Oh, really? So I asked the music director at my home parish, St. Cecilia, well, how about if I play saxophone in the church choir, with the church choir?
So, how'd that go over?
It actually went really well at the
Very
time.
Very good.
So
you must have been a lot better than me.
So I did that, and then from that point, eventually I transitioned to pipe organ. So
all right. And when did you begin the pipe organ?
Well, in college, I was a music theory major. And I did some organ lessons on the side. I didn't start that my first year. From taking piano lessons, that's what I began with, piano and saxophone. So taking piano lessons, we do a weekly performance in the recital hall there. And there was this wonderful, magnificent pipe organ to look at while we were all listening to the piano. And I thought, oh, I got to learn that.
Oh, so good. Excellent. That's the way.
Yeah.
So your real first official lessons on the organ were in college?
Right.
And where was that?
That was at University of Oregon.
Okay. And you were a music theory major.
Right.
And what were you going to do with that?
Well, first I was a music composition major, but that didn't last too long because the emphasis at the time at the school was on atonal music and that kind of thing. And I wanted to write church music. And, You can't have your choir singing atonal things all the time. That doesn't work too well.
My choir sings atonal things all the time, but they're not supposed to be. You know, so, so very good. Well, that's excellent. So now you're, but you also still continued to play piano?
That's right.
Great. And sax, what happened to our sax? Did that drop off after
high
school?
Yeah, that dropped off and went in my closet.
Mine went by the wayside. My father sold that the minute I drove away to college. Now you went on to a master's degree. Finally, we're
right.
Honing in on sacred music here, my friend. Yeah.
Right. So I decided I want a career in church music. So I ended up at the Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C. They offered me a full scholarship.
Oh, great.
I thought, okay, well, I got to go there.
And who were some of the teachers with whom you worked?
So I studied organ with Robert Grogan there and studied
one of the organists at the National Shrine.
And then studied choral music and a bunch of other aspects of sacred music with Leo Nestor, a great composer of choral music. And also had a lot of theology, liturgy, church history instruction from the wonderful faculty over there in the religious studies department.
It's a great school, isn't
it?
And having Leo Nestor, who just retired, we need to get him on the show as well. He's a wonderful Southern California boy
right.
who is now retired. What a great musician he is. So you must have learned so much from Leo. He's a great composer, a great choral person. But Robert Grogan, one of the organists at the National Shrine, I've known Bob for years and years, first coming to know him in my first days at the National Shrine, bringing choirs there. There was a wonderful relationship anyway with one of the music directors from Pittsburgh. So that's how I began to know him first. But besides his role as an organist, his big claim to fame was he was a clarinetteur of the National Shrine. Did he coax you from the organ console up to the Carillon Tower? How did that work?
No, I think I kind of coaxed him into giving me lessons.
So, did he have a class at the university where he actually taught Carillon? Was it a prescribed
subject? It was just
subject?
Me, basically. So I was taking private organ lessons with him and also studying organ literature with him. And I noticed he was the Caroliner at the National Shrine. And I thought, well, this is probably my one chance to learn this instrument. So I asked him for lessons and he was very generous about it.
Oh, great. And how's the Carillon at the National Shrine? Easier to get to than ours, right?
They have an elevator.
Oh. All right. Are you hearing that construction project here at Christ Cathedral? An elevator.
And in the elevator was a little chair you could sit on as you went up.
Oh,
so
my gosh.
You don't have to do any work.
All right. Well, don't just put that out of your head. Don't even think about those days. No, that's not true. So how long did you stay there studying?
I was there for 2 years for the master's program.
Oh, through your master's.
I had to hurry up because that's how long the scholarship lasted.
Yeah, no messing around.
Exactly.
Here. And so were you fascinated by the instrument? Was it a lot like the organ? How did you find that transition? I know all the time have students who are pianists who make that wonderful transition to the organ. We have three wonderful young organ scholars here at the cathedral. We're so happy with them. But what kind of transition is it like from the organ to the fist-pounding carillonneur?
I think it's probably ideal to be both a pianist and an organist before transitioning to carillon, because with piano, you get the touch sensitivity training. And then from the organ, you get the familiarity with the pedal board. So if you take both of those skills and bring them to the carillon, then you're good to go. You just need to learn a few new things.
Because the keyboards are virtually the same. I mean, the little sticks. What do you call those sticks?
Batons, right.
Batons, okay. The little batons. Now I've learned something, and you got that right here at Music from the Tower, folks. The batons that come out that you strike with your fists are arranged just like a keyboard. You'll see that in some pictures that we're going to post up on our website. It's a fascinating thing. It really is to watch somebody play these batons. All right. You don't just say, okay, I've studied a couple of years of carillon, and now I'm a carillonneur. Do you go out and get certified? How does this work?
Well, what I did was, after I just began carillon study in my second year at Catholic University. So I had a year there. Then I moved back to California to work and be with my family. And where I was living at the time in Northridge, there was no carillon nearby. So had a break for a couple of years from the carillon. And then I moved out to Denver to work full-time in a Catholic parish there. And lucky for me, there was the University of Denver right down the street with a wonderful grand carillon. And I would go there every day to practice and take lessons. So I got back into it at that point.
And who was your teacher there?
First, I studied with Todd Fair. And under him, I prepared for my Caroliner exam with the Guild of Caroliners in North America.
So is it kind of like the AGO where we have our associate level and fellow level and choir master certificates? They actually have exams that you pass and you receive some kind of a certification?
Right. There are currently two levels. We have the associate caroliner certification, which we didn't have at that time, so I kind of skipped that one. And then you have the full caroliner member certification, which is what I work towards.
That's excellent. How long did it take you to prepare for that?
I don't remember. Just taking a guess, probably up to a year. It's really high-level repertoire. They have a set list of virtuosic pieces that you have to choose from. And then you prepare a recording of all of these pieces, and you send them to a group of five or six judges.
Examiners, yeah.
Right. And then they listen to it and decide if it's good enough. And if it's good enough, then you get to play at the annual Congress of the Guild of Caroliners. And when you do that, then there's the same panel of judges listening to your live performance. And if you pass that time, then you become certified.
Wow. It sounds complicated.
It was terrifying.
I bet. I know my organist exams. I have 3 degrees from the Organist Guild, and they were equally horrifying, having to play all that repertoire and then take all these written exams. Did you have written exams as well?
No, we didn't. But now for the associate caroliner exam, there is a written portion of that.
Yes, ours was written, and oh my gosh, I can't even think of it. But anyway, happy to have those degrees. Aren't you happy
That's
to have
right.
yours?
All done.
Absolutely. All done. Finished up. Well, you are going to play another piece for us. This is called Prelude No. 7. Now, was this recorded in your Denver time?
Yes, it was. When I was at University of Denver, I would record up there all the time when I was practicing. And
was there a mechanism already set up with microphones and things out in the tower? Or?
I just had a portable digital recorder, and I'd take it and I'd stick the microphone out of one of the windows.
Out the window.
And I found a sweet spot where it worked pretty well. So I'd record my practicing and then listen to it later and make notes about which parts I really needed to focus on. So this is one of my leftover recordings from a practice session.
Well, we're delighted to have it. Our viewers are going to enjoy it very much. We're going to talk a lot more in the next segment about the carillon here at the cathedral, at Christ Cathedral. It's quite unusual, and you're going to be astounded at the statistics on this carillon, how much it weighs and how long it took to hoist into place and all sorts of other things. But in the meantime, here is Prelude No. 7. Tell us the composer.
This is Johannes Franciscus Wolkerik, who is a Romantic period Belgian composer and caroliner.
Also another piece for the carillon.
That's right.
And we will be right back with a lot more from Melissa Widener. Stay tuned. Back with Music from the Tower, and today's topic is the Bell Tower. Here we have Crean Tower right here on our campus. We're going to talk a lot more about our own carillon here at Christ Cathedral. It's a very unusual one. Crean Tower is 23 stories, has blinking lights to keep our planes away from the top of our tower, and also at the top of this giant tower is Melissa's little cabin where she plays the carillon. What's it like climbing up this crazy, terrifying ladder?
Well, that's true. The first few times I did it, it was terrifying. And then, like anything, I got used to it after a while, just focusing on, okay, step by step.
There are just 11 ladders going straight up into the air, and then there's finally a little spiral thing or I forget, another little ladder at the top, a stairway.
That, so it's a 14-story climb, and then at the top of all the ladders, there's a little spiral staircase that leads to the level where the playing cabin is.
And a playing cabin really is just that. It's a little room in the sky. I mean, I was kind of amazed the first time I went up in there, too. I mean, there are little double-hung windows, and there's a little air conditioning and a little desk and a phone and a little TV. And, I mean, it's a pretty nice digs if you once you get up in there.
True.
And the little Carillon keyboard and pedal board sits right in the middle of this room where Melissa does all her magic. Tell us, where are these foundries? Where do these bells come from? Who makes Carillons?
So there are bell foundries all over the world, different sizes. Some make just collections of small bells, like you might have your typical church bell tower that has maybe four bells in it. A lot of small foundries that do that. And then there are the larger foundries that will make instruments like the Carillon. And the ones that I know of that Caroliners talk about a lot that are currently building Carillons, you have Petit en Fritsen in the Netherlands. And then there's another in the Netherlands, IJsbouts, where our Carillon comes from. Very wonderful foundry. They have Carillons all over the place.
They really do. Arlington Cemetery, I think, has one. I mean, they're really all over the place. Longwood Gardens, where you took your exam, that was a Carillon made by IJsbouts.
And then there's Picard in France. That's another large foundry. And Taylor in England. I actually went on a tour of that one when I was visiting England. That was a lot of fun.
That would be great fun. So these bells are cast, right? Actually cast into some kind of a mold? How does that work?
Right. So when a bell is cast, first a mold is made in sand in the ground, and then the molten metal is poured into there, into the sand to cool.
So it's not like they've just got a stockpile of bells and they hook a few together and make you a Carillon.
Right.
These are pretty custom instruments. Actually, many bells bear names, names of donors or little scripture passages. So they're really carved out and made into these. That's just fabulous. Our bells are pretty amazing. We have 52 bells in our tower. That's a lot of bells.
That is a lot of bells.
It's a big, the total weight is 38,000 pounds. But some of the bells are teeny tiny, right?
Right. So the smallest bell in the Carillon, which is the very top of the keyboard when you're playing, is the note E, and that bell weighs only 13 pounds.
That's easy. So I could even do that.
Basically like picking up a bowling ball.
Yeah. But how about the biggest?
The largest bell in the Carillon, which corresponds to the lowest note, a C, weighs 6,270 pounds.
Okay, that's a bigger deal, right?
Wouldn't want to pick that up.
This whole mechanism was actually lifted into our tower by two cranes, right?
Right.
And dropped in. It was actually lifted into place on May 25th, 1990. The tower was dedicated formally as the Crean Tower, September 16th of 1990. But the bells themselves were lifted up in May, so the bell Carillon must have been in place ready to go before the tower was actually dedicated.
Right.
Now, this is such an unusual instrument. So few of you play it. How many Carillonneurs out there would you say there are?
In the United States and Canada, probably around 200 of us. So basically one person per tower, maybe one and a half.
Well, we're happy to have a couple of Carillonneurs that play here, but certainly Melissa is our principal, and she is here playing all the time. We have had the Carillon kind of come to life after a little bit of dormancy here on the campus, and we had our Easter series. We'll talk about more times that the bells have been playing. But there's something very unusual about our Carillon. Everybody knows our Carillon in the Carillon world because it's so unusual. Why is that?
So the typical bell, any kind of large church bell, has a minor third overtone. I'm probably just speaking to musicians here. And this Carillon has a major third overtone, which gives the bell a completely different character. Not only does it sound different, but the bell itself has a bulge in the middle of it, which is what makes that overtone different.
It's kind of funny looking, actually.
It is.
I'm sure the foundry said, "You want what?" And this was sort of the wish of Arvilla Schuller. This is the Arvilla Schuller Carillon. She preferred music in major. We had Fred Swan on the show a few weeks ago, and when Fred said every piece he wrote was big, ended on high C at the top, and was certainly a big blast of major music. And so a minor third overtone, in other words, that's the note that's kind of sounding in the background way up top, was not to be minor in the Arvilla Schuller Carillon,
right,
but was to be major. So they somehow concocted this bulge in the bells to make it so. Does it sound different? Is it what makes, does it work?
It does work. This was the first carillon in this country to have the major third bells. So
but
it
there
was.
There are others.
Right.
Are there more Arvilla Schuller carillons?
No.
So other people have actually requested to have a major third overtone, or it just happened?
I think it must have been requested after people found out about this one.
Wow.
What happened.
So we're trendsetters here at Christ Cathedral. Yay. Okay. But it does sound a little different than the others, huh?
Right. So the overtone series for a regular standard carillon bell and the bells we have here is just completely different. You have a whole different set of partials that are going on.
And are there pieces you can't play because ours is in major and the normal is in minor?
I kind of wondered about that prior to playing this carillon, but having played quite a bit of the standard carillon repertoire at this instrument, it does work. It sounds a little bit different, but it does work.
Well, I'll tell you, just having been music director for a year and a half here, it is amazing how many people call or write or Facebook about our bells. They want to know our bells. They want to see our bells. And we don't have tours, obviously, up 14 ladders. But it is a kind of an unusual anomaly out there that people are enamored with our major third bells. Well, Jim Lawson was the very first carillonneur who played its dedication, also on September 16th of 1990. And he was the carillonneur here until 2003. Who followed him, do you know?
So playing with him at the same time was Rick Breitenbecker, and then he was also the successor after Lawson. And Rick's a friend of mine, and I actually didn't meet him out here, but I met him when I moved to Denver. We both moved to Denver around the same time.
Wow. Was he also studying carillon? Or?
He was playing that instrument for fun while I was studying, so we met each other through the local group of carillonneurs over there.
Little did you know that you'd be following right in his
exactly
ladder footsteps there. Well, we've got a little bit more to hear. We've got a wonderful piece called Image Number 2. So tell us about that piece, also recorded in Denver.
This piece is by Emilien Allard, and he was a 20th century Canadian composer and carillonneur, and part of the Impressionist movement. So if you listen to this piece, it might sound similar to some of Debussy's piano music.
So, and on the bells.
Right. So if Debussy were to have composed for carillon, I think it would have sounded something like this piece. And this piece is another one I played at the University of Denver carillon.
These composer names are certainly not familiar to me.
No,
perhaps
no.
Not our listeners either. So there's like a whole little cast of characters who have written for the carillon. Is this another piece originally composed for the carillon?
Yes. So basically anyone who's a carillonneur tries to make an effort to compose for carillon because we have such a small repertoire, because your standard classical music composers haven't really written for carillon because it's such an obscure instrument.
Well, I'll say it is. And you play it so beautifully every year. We have our little Easter series and certainly use it at other times. And crowds love to hear the carillon play here on our campus. So here is Image Number 2. We will be right back. We have a lot more to share about carillon. Stay tuned. This is Music from the Tower. we are back. This is Music from the Tower, and this is John Romero, your host. And we are enjoying an hour here with Melissa Widener, our carillonneur. Melissa, you're not just a carillonneur, though. You're actually a practicing church musician, piano technician, piano tuner. Tell us a little bit about your other activities.
All right. Well, my full-time career basically is as a piano technician.
What? So. You're not a full-time carillonneur?
Some people are, not many.
I'm sure not.
So I spend most of my time going around to people's homes and tuning and doing maintenance on their pianos. I also work with some churches and schools, and I help out Chapman University quite a bit with concert tunings and then maintenance during their academic breaks.
Well, and help us out here at Christ Cathedral as well. And how do you come about becoming a piano tutor? Let's take a little side trip to that. Did you have to be taught that, or how did that come about?
There are a few different avenues to learn. So some people go to a trade school or a university program for it. There aren't very many of those programs. And some people are completely self-taught. And then others apprentice with someone, which is what I did. So I apprenticed with another piano technician for 2 years.
Wow. Okay. Well, you know, in France, all the blind organists that we got, the two options for blind children of music in France was you could become the piano tuner or you could become an organist. So somehow a lot of our great organists took the road of organ. All right. But we've zeroed away from our carillon talk here. There are lots of other bells and towers that are actually not carillon. Talk a little bit about change ringing. What does that mean? We just had the big anniversaries of Queen Elizabeth in London. We heard these incredible change rings. And what is that? Is that just some kind of a mechanism that rings all these bells or people involved? What's going on there?
So a change ringing tower or system doesn't look like a carillon if you'd look at both in towers and compare them to each other. So with change ringing, you have a small collection of bells, and there's a rope connected to each bell, and an individual person will be responsible for one bell, and then they have these change rings, which are mathematical sequences basically of a short ringing pattern with a small variation in that pattern every time the pattern is repeated.
Well, and when you listen to it, you think, wow, that's just fabulous. But when you think of it, it would make me insane. You know,
me too.
I mean, it might go 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. But the next time it might go 8, 6, 7 takes, uh-huh. You know, and on and on. Every time there's a little variation. And I was lucky enough to be in England one summer on choir tour with my own choir. And we heard some change ringing, and we went over to this little church near our hotel, climbed up the stairs, and there they were practicing. I guess they don't have practice change ringing. So they were practicing in the little village, and it was just fascinating. And they'd get like a third of the way through this change ring, and somebody would blow it. And they'd have to start all over, you know, and it was really quite fun. And some of our folks were there trying to, after they finished their practice, they let us pull some of the bells, and you know, one of the bells took my wife right up into the air. She's so tiny. It was just great fun to observe this, but I can't imagine the concentration and discipline
exactly
that must take. Of course, there are also, besides carillon and change ringing, there are handbells. We have lots of parishes here at the cathedral. We have 4.5 octaves of handbells, Schumerich handbells, and they're beautiful. And we use them in worship and liturgy and play songs once in a while. But not as much as Pat Otero used to do here. She really had a lot of very beautiful handbell ringing. So that's quite different again, isn't it?
Right. And you can use handbells also for change ringing, which I've done. I used to direct children's handbell choirs. And I had never seen those kids concentrate so much as when they were doing a change ring, and they loved it.
Oh, my gosh. I can't imagine it. But it might really help them focus. I mean, we don't need those spinner things. We can use handbells and concentrate on a change ring. Do you think handbells were sort of the outgrowth, or did that come about backdoored through carillon playing or through, because they really are, there's whole guilds of handbell ringers and festivals and handbells all over the place now.
I think that handbells came about as a way to practice change ringing.
Yeah, maybe it just kind of backdoored its way into being
right.
its very own instrument on its own. Well, here at Christ Cathedral, we have our Easter series. That's every Wednesday for 20 minutes. Melissa plays for the 7 weeks of the Easter season. She has played such beautiful things for us, and people come onto our campus at 12:40 every single Wednesday of the Easter season. This year, we had a little bit colder weather than normal, but our crowds were pretty good. People bring their own chairs, bring their picnic lunches. We have food trucks. It's an event, and it's all because of you, Melissa. It's great. The Easter series has been a challenge for you to dig up enough repertoire to play 7 weeks in a row, or how's that gone?
It hasn't been much of a challenge, really. I have a good repertoire of music, and I know that hymns are really audience-friendly, especially here. So I can choose a couple of hymns every time and improvise on those hymns, and the audience just loves it because they can hum along or
they
sing along.
They know that, too. Right? Now, I'm kind of walking around working the crowd and helping people get Melissa on Facebook Live. that's been a big thing at this season, so they can watch her. But they are humming the tunes. These are wonderful hymns they know, and it's all mixed in with great pieces that are carillon pieces as well. We have a couple of other carillonneurs that visit us. Tell us about Wes.
So Wesley has been a guest a couple of times here playing recitals, and I met Wesley through the Guild of Carillonneurs. It's such a small group of musicians that we pretty much all know each
know
other.
Everyone.
So it's like
yeah.
a big family. And Wesley went to UC Berkeley, and that's where I think he learned to play.
And he plays at the carillon at Riverside? Is that his home carillon?
Actually, sometimes he drives all the way up to Berkeley, and he still plays there.
Oh, wow. Isn't that great?
Right.
Well, he was magnificent. We've also had Stephen Ball, who used to be the carillon teacher at University of Michigan. He's now playing the world's largest organ at Boardwalk Hall, but has still kept his carillon chops. He came out and played for us. Perhaps we'll have him again at some point. But the carillon has taken on a new life here at Christ Cathedral. Besides our own series of carillon pieces, people now really begin to think of the carillon as an instrument that we use for festive occasions. And I love that. And that's because of your dedicated work here that two things have happened, really. We've used it for many, many occasions. We use it on Memorial Day. You play all sorts of patriotic things for us on Memorial Day. That's been fabulous. We used it for the floor signing event when we sort of consecrated the room with floor signing of the floor and people sort of just kind of getting to know the inside of the building before renovations. Contract signing. We've even used it for people's wedding anniversaries and actually funerals as well.
Right. I think that about covers it.
Well,
but there are so many ways to creatively use the carillon, so I'm looking forward to see what happens with it.
Yes, well, and of course our dedication will be coming up, so I'm sure we'll have it. Fred Swan a few weeks ago said on a show that the carillon played every single Sunday. And that it played a half an hour before every organ recital. I mean, it really played a lot. But he goes, no one paid any attention to it. It just was up there playing. And now Romeri's got a sideshow going on over there because we've got food trucks and picnic. People are bringing their picnic baskets and bottles of wine. And it's just an event here with
it
you
is.
Playing every week. Then they watch her climb up and they watch her climb down. As soon as she's finished playing, they all race over to the base of Crean Tower and watch her climb down. They can't wait to have her climb down and take pictures with her and everything else. So it really has been so much fun having you come and do our Easter series. But stay tuned. If you're not tuned into Christ Cathedral Music Facebook page or ChristCathedralMusic.org website, there's lots of information, and we always let you know when you can come on campus and hear the carillon play. Well, any last words of good news for carillons here that you want to share with us, Melissa, before you introduce your last piece?
Well, I think we're the big part of the good news for carillons with these great audiences we've been getting and tourists from all over the world. I mean, they're coming here to go to Disneyland and they hear about our recitals somehow, so they come to hear the carillon, or they're visiting their family and they come to hear the carillon, so I think that's wonderful.
We also have the UC Medical Center. People have found out about it over there. They're coming over from the campus. So So you too, mark that down, Easter Wednesdays, right here at Christ Cathedral. Well, Melissa, thank you so much for teaching us. I learned a couple new words too. I hope you folks out in Radio Land have done the same. Tell us a little bit about our very last piece of the day.
The Toccata Festival is from Suite No. 1 for Carillon by John Corder. So John Corder was a caroliner and composer for Carillon. And his original compositions for Carillon are among the most frequently performed of Carillon music because they make such good use of the particular characteristics of the Carillon, especially that minor third that we've talked about.
Does that work on our Carillon without our minor third? Might be a little tricky, huh?
It does work. It just sounds a little different.
Okay. And where was this piece recorded?
This recording is from a recital I did at Christ Church Cranbrook in Bloomfield Hills, Michigan.
Okay. So you have heard Melissa playing four different wonderful pieces on a couple of different carillons, and you can hear her live right here at Christ Cathedral. So, Melissa, thank you so much for being on Music from the Tower.
Thank you for inviting me.
It's my pleasure. I'm sure we'll have you back many times when it gets closer to the Easter season. You can give us a preview of some of the things that are coming up. And in the meantime, this is John Romeri wishing you a very good week. And until next time, encouraging you to go out and listen to a live performance of some great music. This is Music from the Tower, and we'll see you next week.